Our final case for this morning is United States against Snyder. Ms. Christensen?
May it please the court. Counsel. Excuse me. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joanna Christensen. I represent the appellant, James Snyder, in this case. As the court is aware, the 8-year sentence in this case was probably the most severe sentence upon revocation the court has ever seen, and certainly that I have ever seen. It was unreasonable because it was based on only grade C violations, and the recommended guideline range was 3 to 9 months.
So let me ask you, Ms. Christensen, there are two ways of approaching this case. One of them is to focus on the fact that, at least I don't see where the district court actually put on the record its view of the recommended range under Chapter 7 of the guidelines, which is actually very low, 3 to 9 months.
Right.
And say, well, you know, we needed to hear that first before you went up to the 96. The other way is just to say, well, it's pretty obvious the court wasn't going to use those recommended that recommended range, but that 96 months is just so high as to be unreasonable. What's your focus here?
I think, and in our brief, we essentially made both arguments because I think it's alternatives. I think the fact is that the judge did not consider the guideline range. And that's statutorily mandated to at least consider it. Supervised release guideline ranges have always been advisory. Booker didn't really change that. And to not consider it at all is a significant violation, particularly since the difference between the guideline range and the ultimate sentence is astronomical.
I think that, I'm groping for the theory, given the way Judge Lindbergh responded to Mr. Snyder as to what we think would have happened. You think the judge would have said, oh, wow, you know, I'm thinking of a tenfold increase. Maybe I better rethink. Or the judge basically says, I'm going to incapacitate Mr. Snyder as long as I can.
Correct. I think that that's a significant problem in and of itself. As the government argues, that any consideration of the guideline range would have been pro forma. That's not the way we expect district court judges to treat the guidelines. They're supposed to be given respect even after Booker, and certainly all the time at least considered. It's very possible that Judge Lindbergh would not have given him a different sentence, a lower sentence, would have still chose to give him the highest sentence. But the problem is the judge didn't even consider all of the factors the judge was supposed to consider. So it's in some ways a procedural challenge, but also it's a substantive challenge to the sentence. Because, because of the length of the sentence, which is, of course, 4 supervised release terms stacked on top of each other, and basically to incapacitate him, to protect the public, where there's no evidence in the record that he was at a great risk of reoffending.
Well, wait a minute now. He had just started on supervised release, and a modification of the terms were made to prohibit the internet use, and then he uses it for prohibited use and essentially flouts the order of the court regarding the sex offender treatment, just literally only shows up and sleeps through it or acts as if he's sleeping through it. That's a pretty dangerous situation, given the nature of the underlying crime here.
I agree, Your Honor. And in my brief, I analogize it to a drug addict or an alcoholic who has been in prison for a crime related to their addiction and having a difficult time adjusting to treatment, which, as the court is well aware, isn't always perfect, and in many times there are slip-ups. And what's important to note is that he was released onto supervised release in April, so it was about 6 months total on release. The conditions were modified in the middle of June because, in my understanding of the record is that when he was originally convicted in 1997, those conditions were not automatic. So they went back and put the internet and the computer restrictions on. He did violate those restrictions shortly thereafter, but only the one time. He, after he had the confrontation with the probation officer about it, he did not violate that provision again. And the probation officer actually waited 3 months before bringing that to the court's attention. So I think that, that particularly the internet usage is not that serious. It was legal pornography, and everybody agrees that it was legal pornography. It may have depicted a fantasy element, but it was legal pornography.
Well, the record suggests that the judge would have imposed the same sentence regardless of the guideline range because he believed the violations were very serious and that Snyder was a threat to the public. Doesn't that mean that any error would have been harmless?
I don't think that harmless error is really a problem in this case because we have so many issues getting to the point where Judge Lindenberg got, particularly not considering the guideline range, but also not considering any other 3553A factors other than incapacitating him. The judge did not consider that the doctor who was treating him said he was at a mild risk to reoffend.
I thought he said moderate.
In the facts, it was mild in the discharge summary, a mild risk to reoffend. And there are certainly, it's clear that Mr. Snyder's relationship with this doctor did not go well. And even for after all of that, for the doctor to say he was merely a mild risk to reoffend.
On page 7, Dr. Simmons.
Of my factual.
Of your facts, yeah. Yes.
And the discharge, I believe it's page 2 or 3 of the discharge summary.
Discharge summary 1, yeah.
Yeah. And he, you know, these are grade C violations. And the cases, and I could cite all kinds of grade C violation cases, almost all of them are unpublished. I cited a few that are most recent. And only from this circuit, but if you look circuit or across the circuits, this is just so out of the ordinary, so different from every other grade C violation revocation sentence imposed, that in itself cannot make it harmless, that it has to be
essentially a disparity argument.
Yes, and that the A6 argument is made in our brief. And of course, those arguments are difficult. I don't want to cite every case ever decided with a grade C violation. But in those cases, they're very similar. If they're white-collar offenders, their grade C violation is a type of step towards reoffending.
Let me go back, too, to the sentencing hearing itself, because the prosecutor refers to it as a moderate. That's when we picked up this moderate risk to reoffend.
Yes.
Whereas the discharge summary is mild risk.
Correct.
And so that was a misstatement by the prosecutor.
I believe so. The quote in the factual statement of our brief is a direct quote from the discharge summary, which I believe is in the record, and if it's not, it should be. It was introduced at the hearing. So it's, again, you know, I think that harmless error is certainly, in these cases, always a consideration because the standard of review is so low. But I would argue that this case goes above and beyond anything else that I have ever seen, that the court has ever seen, in the length of time for very minor violations. If he were, like I said, an alcoholic and drank and perhaps drove drunk, which also puts the community at risk, perhaps even more significant risk, more immediate risk, he would not have gotten 8 years. And I think that's the significant issue in this case. Unless the court has further questions, I'll reserve my time.
I couldn't find the record, but wasn't there some documentation before the judge that this was a Class C, that these were Class C allegations?
Sure. The probation officer would have, I believe they call it a special report. I think it varies by jurisdiction. And it had the summary in it. It said guideline range 3 to 6 months, criminal history category.
So that was before the court, though he didn't specifically refer to it.
Right. And it's similar to in a regular sentencing hearing. The guideline range is always going to be in the pre-sentence report. And I know this court assumes that the district court reads the pre-sentence report. So I think we're safe in assuming the judge had read the probation officer's special report. The problem is that the judge has a statutory duty to consider the guideline range, and without making mention of it, it's hard to understand how the court could have fulfilled that duty.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Ness.
May it please the Court, my name is John Ness, and I represent the United States. With the Court's permission, I'd like to skip directly to the discharge summary, which is under seal. It is part of the record. I do have a copy in front of me. I would like to read. This goes to the point about whether it was a mild or moderate risk. This is from the discharge summary dated September 15, 2009, from Dr. Ronald C. Simmons. And it says that Mr. Snyder was found at a psychosexual evaluation conducted on June 1, 2009, to be at moderate risk to reoffend and in denial regarding ownership of his offense behavior. His developmental history, personal dynamics, and pattern of offending represented an individual with an offense style that does not avoid offending. These individuals are automatic, impulsive, and unsophisticated in their offense behavior and in need of treatment to facilitate behavior control. At the end, in the final sentence, actually, the discharge summary, Dr. Simmons, who was the person who was treating this defendant in his sex offender treatment, said that Mr. James Snyder is discharged as unsuccessful from my sex offender-specific treatment program due to noncompliance. His negative attitude towards treatment, in conjunction with his prominent thinking errors and other risk factors, inflate his established moderate risk level to reoffend. So he started out at a moderate risk level, and then he did not succeed in sex offender treatment in any way. And Dr. Simmons, the expert here, the person closest on the ground, said that his established moderate level was inflated.
So here's my problem with this case, Mr. Ness. As we all know, we've gotten used to this drill, especially in the post-Booker world for regular sentences and always for supervised release. There's a procedural dimension of the way this court looks at what the district court has done, and a substantive dimension. And my offhand sense is very, very rarely does this court interfere with a district court's decision on what's a reasonable sentence. Occasionally we have at great extremes, but it's very rare. But the quid pro quo has been that we've policed rather carefully the procedural regime that the Supreme Court has laid out in cases like Gall and cases like, you know, the whole group of cases. And in our decision, United States against Neal, we applied this to the revocation of supervised release. And we haven't stated this as an option. We've said to reach a reasonable sentence, the district court must begin its analysis with the recommended imprisonment ranges found in 7B1.4, et cetera. So I'm very concerned that when the district court just doesn't touch that base, doesn't tell us, yes, I know this is a 3 to 9 month range, but I'm going to multiply it times 10 for these reasons. It's such an extreme change. I don't know how we can say, well, even though the Supreme Court says you must begin with the guideline range, we don't think you really have to. This isn't a case of miscalculation of range. It's a case where there's just not a word uttered.
I have two responses to that, Your Honor. First of all, as we said in our brief, it's our position that this, under the unique circumstances of this case, this wasn't an error because the range was so plainly inadequate.
You're going to be here tomorrow and the next day and next week and next month saying in the unique circumstances of this case. You're always here when you think that a particular sentence was appropriate. So I don't know what's so unique about this case. This guy commits a few grade C violations. He's got a terrible attitude with his – I don't think anybody's debating about whether he should have had the supervised release revoked. The question is, did the district judge go through the correct procedures for selecting the appropriate sentence?
Assuming that that was an error, not to explicitly mention the guidelines, and it's a distinct point because, as Judge Tinder mentioned, this was before, and as I believe the appellant's counsel stated, this was before the judge, the guideline range.
But we've seen lots of cases like that, but we ask the district judge, because district judges disagree with guideline computations. District judges frequently, I mean, not like every day, but it's not uncommon for a probation officer to come up with a range and the judge to say, no, you know, I think it needs to be regarded in a different way. So just because the judge reads a report doesn't mean that, without even uttering the words, I agree with the special report or anything, I'm not sure that total silence will do.
Well, Judge Wood, assuming that total silence was an error here, it is our position as well, and this is the second part of our response, that the plain error doctrine applies, because under the narrow situation we face here, where nobody uttered the word sentencing guidelines when the sentence was handed down, including the defendant's counsel, under these circumstances, it would have been very simple for the defense counsel to say at the revocation hearing, Your Honor, we need to look at the guidelines range, and he should be sentenced within the guidelines or below the guidelines or not too far above the guidelines. The defendant's counsel never did that. And it's our position that plain error applies here.
Well, here we have such a significant deviation between the sentence and the guideline range. Why isn't this a unique situation? And because of the deviation, we should get some clarity as to what the district court's judge's view was.
I think there are a couple of points about that, Judge Williams. First of all, yes, this is the guideline range was far below the sentence that was imposed. That cries out even more for putting some onus on the defense counsel for saying, hey, wait a second, Judge, this is way above what the guidelines are recommending. The defendant's counsel never mentioned that because it's plain from the record nobody thought a guideline sentence was going to work here for this defendant. So that's why the plain error doctrine applies here. And nobody mentioned, including defendant's counsel, most importantly, that the guidelines were not discussed at the sentencing hearing.
When does he have the chance to do that? I mean, the court announces the sentence on page 19 of the transcript, and then they start talking right away about appellate rights. I don't know. I mean, the court's now pronounced the sentence. What notice is there for the defendant that this extreme increase is going to happen?
Well, the defendant's counsel spoke first at the sentencing hearing, or the revocation hearing, and he never mentioned sentencing guidelines there. And then he was also on notice based on what the government lawyer said, that the government was seeking 8 years. And I believe that the defense counsel had a chance to respond at that point. And he never said anything again. So there was a chance before the judge imposed sentence for the defendant's counsel to mention the sentencing guidelines. And I think that's the point.
Did you say the government counsel was arguing for 8 years?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. And then the government didn't give any rationale based on the guidelines either when recommended 8 years, like saying, and we recommend 8 years, we recognize the guidelines, it's a grade C and the normal sentence would be this, but because of the fact that he's failed to do this and he's failed to do this, we think, you know, three times as much, or actually it's way more than that, is adequate. You know, so the government didn't put that in their recommendation, just says as a bottom line, transcript 13, and we're asking the court to sentence him to 8 years, but makes no reference to the guidelines either or tying it to that.
That is correct, Your Honor. But for purposes of the plain error test, the onus is on the defendant to raise the issue that later...
if it's plain error, I'm not sure it is. I mean, obviously, we know that that's... You argued that in your brief, so I understand that's your position.
The point here, really, about the plain error or even harmless error under Rule 52 is that a remand for consideration of the guideline sentence would not result in a different sentence. And that's the point of the Palladino cases.
Well, we don't know. I mean, we don't assume district judges willfully ignore everything that we say up here.
No, that's true, Your Honor. But by the same token, when you have a situation where, as was mentioned in the Anderson case that's cited in our brief, where this court said that plain error applies when we're talking about the sentencing guidelines with respect to the supervised release range, it's the same point. We're talking about a situation where the issue could have been addressed at the sentencing hearing by the defendant's lawyer saying something. And when we have a judge here, as Judge Lindberg said, I want to sentence this defendant to the maximum possible term I legally can. It's clear that the judge was not interested in anything less than that. And so a remand would be pointless because it wouldn't affect the sentence if it went back. And that's the point of the Anderson case.
But isn't the point of Gall that when the district judge has the guidelines range clearly in front of him or her, then maybe it's a chance for one last bit of reflection, and maybe the judge is thinking of this maxim that says, wow, you know, in terms of disparities and the like, maybe I need to think again. Sentencing is not just a completely capricious, individualized exercise.
That certainly is what Gall said, Your Honor.
Gall says that, so.
But again, we're talking here under plain error or even harmless error about an error. If it's an error, then the question is whether the error can be noticed and corrected upon sending it back. And that's our point about plain error and harmless error.
Now, the probation officer said after the prosecutor spoke that he was not taking the position he should be sentenced to 8 years, correct? He was taking the position he should be sentenced to 9 months on each count, which would be a total of 36 months.
That's correct.
Followed by 27 months on each of supervised release to run concurrently.
That's correct, Judge. And that gives rise to the inference, and again, the district judge did not mention the sentencing guidelines. That's obvious from the transcript. But that does give a little more comfort to this court that the judge had the special report in front of him. He had the probation officer mentioning what was equivalent to a stacked term of maximum sentences under the guidelines. The judge, an inference can be drawn from this that the judge was aware of what was before him with the sentencing guidelines. He wasn't interested in that because, for all the reasons that are set forth in the record, this was a dangerous person who needed to be incapacitated for as long as possible.
So then whenever we have a dangerous person who needs to be incarcerated for a long time, we waive that requirement of articulating the guidelines.
No, Your Honor.
Or discussing. I mean, essentially that's what we would be doing if we found. I mean, it certainly could fit other cases.
Well, I disagree, and I realize this is my third question I'm answering after my red line is on, if I may have leave to answer.
Judge Williams' question.
I don't think that's the situation here, Judge, because what we're talking about with respect to the guidelines error, if it indeed was an error, is a plain error issue.
If we disagree with you on plain error, then we're in the area that Judge Williams is concerned about.
Then we're in the area of whether it's harmless error. And again, looking at the cases like United States versus George that we cited in a footnote, again, we're in a situation where we're talking about harmless error, where the question there is what would happen on remand, not whether there was an error, but what would happen on remand? Would it make a difference? And this is a unique case because we know it wouldn't make a difference because we have it in black and white in the sentencing transcript that Judge Lindbergh. Thank you, Your Honor.
We have that point.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Christensen, we'll give you a little bit of extra time if you need that for your rebuttal.
I won't go over what we've already talked about again. I did want to point out that in my brief, we cited United States versus Sullivan, which is actually technically an unpublished case. But it's a supervised release revocation case that says that the defendant doesn't have to make an objection to the reasonableness of the sentence, adopting this court's stance in regular sentences from Castro-Juarez. So unless the court has any other questions, I won't belabor the issues we already covered and ask the court to remand for resentencing.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks
to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning.